Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I'm doing this interview today solo. I know a lot of you tune in just to hear my mom because she's at 86. She has a lot to offer, but so she'll be back with us soon. Anyway, we have a really fascinating book today, and the whole story, the story of how the book was written, I think is as interesting as the story that the book is about. And it is called The Field House, A Writer's Life Lost and Found on an Island in Maine by Robin Clifford Wood. And Robin has a BA from Yale, an MA in English from the University of Rochester, and an MFA in Creative Writing from the University of Southern Maine. During 25 years as a full-time mom, she published local human interest features in New Hampshire and New York and Massachusetts and spent 7 years as a regular columnist. She began teaching writing at the college level in 2015. Her articles have appeared in many magazines, and she's known for the powerful essay, How Do You Help Your Parents Die? Her award-winning poetry has received national recognition. She lives in central Maine with her husband and dogs, and this is, The Field House is her first book. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Robin.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
So give us the story of Rachel, kind of a background of Rachel Field. I have to admit, I had not heard of her before I read your book.
Well, that gives me a great segue into one of my favorite lines, which was one of my very favorite reviews that came out not long ago by Alan Adams in a local newspaper said, "Before I read this book, I had never heard of Rachel Field, and now I'll never forget her." So that was how he closed the review, and that was music to my ears because that's exactly what I am hoping for. If you live in Downeast Maine, that's the southern eastern coast of Maine, there's a higher likelihood that you've heard of Rachel Field and maybe familiar with some of her books and her poetry. But in many other parts of the country, she's all but disappeared, except for people who are fans of Hitty dolls. There's a lot of doll collectors who remain Rachel Field fans because Rachel Field was the first woman to win a Newbery Award for children's literature, and the protagonist of her award-winning book was named Hitty, and she was a doll that lived. It's called Hitty, Her First 100 Years, and it tells the stories of this wooden doll carved on an island in Maine. Many of her books were set in Maine, and Hitty has adventures all over the world in her 100-year history of belonging to many different people, and she tells a lot of history through the eyes of this doll, and it was a hugely popular book in its day, and there remain doll enthusiasts who are huge fans of Hitty even today.
Are there still Hitty dolls? Can you buy a Hitty doll today?
Mostly doll people make their own Hitty dolls.
Ah.
There's an original Hitty doll who was only about 6 inches tall that's in the Stockbridge, Massachusetts library. That was Rachel Field's childhood home. But mostly people make – I've seen Hitty dolls that are, 5 feet tall, and I've seen them jointed and not jointed. People make all kinds of dolls, in the style of Hitty. It's quite a world. I had never known anything about the doll world before I started researching Rachel Field's background.
Well, I got to say that this, as you were talking about how she wrote this story involving all these historical events and Hitty being part of all these historical events, it reminds me of Forrest Gump.
Oh, yes. It's very similar. Very similar premise to that.
So, I wonder if that's where where the writer of Forrest Gump got the idea.
Yeah. I don't know. That's very funny. That could well be. It's a way of retelling history. That's a cool idea.
Yeah.
So Rachel Field was born in 1894. She was astonishingly prolific, especially given that she died young at 47. but she published something along the lines of 32 or 33 books. It's hard to count because some are anthologized and some are collections. She published a lot of what they called juveniles back in her day, which are children's books, those small books that are, I don't know, about as big as a CD case or something,
mm-hmm.
DVD case. But she also published, she also won the National Book Award for novels. She wrote four or five books for adults. One was a biography, four were novels. Three of them were made into films, and one of them was nominated for Best Picture and starred Bette Davis, who became a great friend of Rachel Fields, and she finished her life in Hollywood as a rising star. Disney chose her to write the lyric for the Ave Maria segment in Fantasia, and she was on a short list that I have in that I got to see in some of my archive research, where they were discussing who they wanted to be the screenwriter for Gone with the Wind. And Rachel Field was on this list that included William Faulkner and Sinclair Lewis and Thornton Wilder. And
I found that interesting, even though they would not let her be the screenwriter for her own books.
Well, I'm not sure if they didn't let her or if she wasn't interested, but she never did do any screenwriting. I just know that this was a like an insider document in one of the places I did my research was in the Warner Brothers Studios and at the Academy Library in Hollywood. So, this book took me far afield.
pun intended.
I can't help it. She also, one of her poems called Prayer for a Child won the Caldecott Medal after Rachel died. So there's the background of Rachel Field. She was quite renowned, a rising star, and then died quite suddenly at age 47. And the explanations were unclear. I mean, she died of complications after surgery, but it was never really specified. And that was one of the things when So I should back up a bit now. I'm
okay.
Babbling on. Would you like me to talk about how I got connected to Rachel Field?
Yeah, that's a good place to circle back to.
Okay. So the book title, it's called A Writer's Life, Lost and Found on an Island in Maine. And the Field House is the name of Rachel Field's summer house, or that is what it has been called for, 50 years by Sutton Islanders. Sutton Island is this tiny mile-long island on off the coast of Maine, off of Mount Desert Island. And Rachel ended up falling in love with the state of Maine when she was a teenager and started spending every summer on Sutton. And in 1922, she bought this house. She called it the Playhouse because she used money from her plays to buy it. And then spent every summer there and wrote a ton there, and it inspired a lot of her most successful writing of all kinds. And then my husband and I bought that very house in 1994.
And were you familiar with Rachel at that time?
Barely. I was, like many people, I hadn't really heard. What I knew was a poem called If Once You Have Slept on an Island, You'll Never Be Quite the Same. It's this lovely lyrical poem, very popular along the coast of Maine where there's tons of islands. But I also found a copy of it in my great aunt's house on an island in a lake in the Adirondacks of New York. So I think island people all over the world have gravitated to this poem. But once I started spending time in that house, I was intrigued by this, I guess the presence of this creative spirit from the past, because this island has no roads, there's no facilities. You carry your baggage in a wheelbarrow or on your back to get, across the mile-long island to the house from where the ferry drops you off. So when people sell a house, they tend to sell it full of all the stuff that you had there. So her books are on the shelves. She has magazines in the attic. There's souvenirs she brought back from Europe in 1920 that I found in drawers at galley, proofs of one of her poetry books. So, I mean, I was like, it really felt like I was living with her stuff. And I started reading her work. I adored her poetry. It's this lovely, uplifting, philosophical, sort of this beautiful outlook on the ups and downs of life and the insights into humanity. And I just loved it. And
it's very accessible.
Yes.
Like the meaning of the poem is not, you don't have to go searching for it. It's right there.
No,
but
that's right.
But it's said in a way that, you know, it's conveyed in a way that is like, oh, I never quite saw it that way before.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Could I read you one poem just to give you an idea? So she wrote, a lot of her earliest poetry was from, was children's poetry. But I think that most successful children's poetry also appeals to adults. So here's one
definitely
that I really like. It's called Some People. Isn't it strange some people make you feel so tired inside? Your thoughts begin to shrivel up like leaves all brown and dried. But when you're with some other ones, it's stranger still to find your thoughts as thick as fireflies all shiny in your mind. And I love that. And that's a lot of her poetry talks about how people can lift others up or put them down, and kind of makes the point of how simple it is to add beauty and delight into the world rather than knocking people back. So,
you know, her poetry also reminds me a bit of A.A. Milne's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And that he would have been writing maybe a little bit earlier than her, but, you know, kind of the same time period. She was born in 1894.
Yes.
I think he was born in 1882. But, he's famous, of course, for Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
But he also wrote children's poetry. And there's a poem that I've always has always stuck with me about. It's called Have You Been a Good Girl, Jane?
Uh-huh.
And it's so... But anyway, her work reminded me of that.
Yes, I can very much see that. There's a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson sometimes in some of them too, I think.
Yes.
Like the I'd love to go up in a swing. That, you know, some of it is the rhythms and whimsical nature of them are similar. Yeah, I agree with you. So I've started to get really enchanted by her work, and then I started asking about the woman herself. And once I started looking into the research locally, there were all these mysteries about her life. First of all, no one really knew exactly what she died of, because it was really out of nowhere. There was also talk about, did she have children? And some people thought, yes, I think she had a daughter, but where no trace of any daughter living today. So if she did have a daughter, where is she now? And I thought she had infertility issues. There's whispers about that. And she had this very late. She didn't marry till she was 40, and she married an actor. But she kind of came from a pedigreed sort of aristocratic line, even though her family itself was not well-to-do at all. And I think there was talk about maybe it was this, you know, inappropriate match. And then there was a sister who maybe had been at Sutton with her for years and then disappeared also. Like, what happened to her? And maybe she, you know, there was madness in the family. You know, there's all these things. I thought, what the heck is all this about? And so I started, the other big mystery was in her adult poetry, there's really intense heartbreak in a lot of her poems in her collection called Fear is the Thorn. But her relationship with Arthur Peterson, who she married at age 40, showed nothing. And all the archives and the letters that I read, I didn't see anything about that indicated any kind of angst or heartache that showed up in these poems. And I thought, who was this love interest in her life that that drew this from her. And it took me years and years before I found the answers to all these questions. And most of them, I got most of them.
So had no one ever written a biography of her before?
No. No, this is the first one. There had been sort of academic articles that were very useful to me, but no full bio. I should say a caveat on that. One of Rachel Field's best friends wrote a biography of her in the 1960s, and I read her letters. Her name was Ruth Feiss, and I read Ruth's letters tracing the writing of the book. She'd been, all the people she interviewed, she talked about, and she said, now I'm up to the college years, and now I'm writing this part of her life. And then she said, I'm sending it off to the Rand McNally, who are publishing the book. I think it might have been a biography for young people. And then I could find no trace of the book. That book seemed to absolutely disappear. And I have no idea what became of it, but I have a theory. You want to hear
it? What's your theory? Yes, I do. You can't leave us hanging there, Robin.
So, my theory is that because Rachel's family, she had her husband, and there was an adopted daughter, in fact. After Rachel's death, her family just sank. It just seemed like they had a tough time. Now, maybe her daughter had some good years, but she died at age 21. That death was so tragic, and the husband had always been very private about sharing anything personal. And it was right around the time that Hannah died that Ruth's book was headed for the publisher. And I bet that that when that happened, that Arthur Peterson said, forget it. I don't want anything published about Rachel. I don't want to bring this into the public eye anymore. That's my theory. So I think that book that was written about Rachel's life just got shut down and shoved into a closet somewhere. Who knows?
Did you try and trace Ruth's family to see if somebody has the manuscript?
I did. I ended up speaking to, let's see, so Ruth also had an adopted daughter, and I spoke to that daughter's grandson, or maybe a son. But when I asked him about it, he said, no, I think it was her son. I tracked him down, and he said, well, I can ask Mom, but she's, very, very old, and her memory isn't very good anymore. And he said he would look into it, but I can't retrace. I'm pretty sure that he asked her about it. Who knows in how much detail, but he got nothing. So that's as far as I tracked that down. I also tried Rand McNally. But they just make maps now, and I guess they used to have a book branch. But
oh wow, it would be interesting to find that.
Yeah, it really would. It would. There are a few untapped trails still that I haven't found, but most of the ones that were burning my curiosity, I got to figure out.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Robin Clifford Wood, author of The Field House, A Writer's Life Lost and Found on an Island in Maine. There's so many sort of things to talk about in this book.
Yeah.
One of them is just, the fact that Rachel was able to do what she did as a woman of her time, and tell us a little bit about her upbringing and how she became a writer.
Oh, thank you for that question. I would love to talk about that. So some of this was just absolutely in Rachel's spirit. One interesting thing about Rachel was that she said she literally could write before she could read. She had an incredible memory for hearing reading. People read aloud to her all the time, both her mother and Aunt Kitty, who raised Rachel and her sister, because her dad died when Rachel was a baby. But also the little local schoolhouse she attended in Stockbridge, they read aloud to them all the time. And Rachel would memorize poems on a single reading. They put on plays, and Rachel would have every part memorized in no time. She played the part of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice when she was nine. And so I think she was exposed to tons of reading. But by listening. And so she wrote, she could form letters, but didn't really, and knew how to make her name, but she couldn't read herself until she was 10 years old. But she always loved the writing part. She lived next door to the Stockbridge Library. And once she did start reading, she started reading St. Nicholas Magazine. That's where she published her first piece when she was 16. And she started writing, as a child. She made a little handmade book by sewing pages together and wrote B-O-O-K on it. That was her first book. And so
But was there anything on the pages?
No, she talked very specifically about being reluctant to mar the blank pages. So her first book was just a book of promise, I guess. But she did. She wrote in high school. She was recognized by her high school classmates as a writer. I think she wrote the class poem. And she went to Radcliffe. She couldn't get into Radcliffe because she wasn't a great student in many ways, but she had this gift for writing. So they accepted her as a special student, which is a category they had back then that no longer exists. And she did attend Radcliffe for 4 years and studied writing, playwriting, and ended up getting a job in New York City as reading synopses for a play company.
So I thought that was interesting. The special student status meant that she would never get a degree,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's fascinating to me that even existed.
Yeah.
So that they recognize, okay, we don't want to give a degree to this person because they're not smart enough to represent us,
yeah.
but we still want them here.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that funny? So, well,
yeah.
Thank goodness they did have that. And it seems like something they ought to still do, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although the denying of the degree feels like a little slap in the face. I don't know. It's kind of like a weighted gift in a way. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of schools that will let you audit a class, take classes without getting credit for them.
Right. Right. I guess
so. Maybe it's similar to that.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
I guess that's right. So anyway, she worked her tail off. She wrote feverishly and worked very hard on all the details. She was also an illustrator, so. She wrote, she illustrated, she edited, she designed her covers. I mean, she was sort of an editor's dream, and editors really enjoyed working with her, although she got tough when she got successful. She was a tough negotiator, and she just was a pretty driven woman, but always just sort of known for being the most generous and delightful friend and storyteller, and had this musical voice. And, enchanting presence. People just adored her. But I think she just had a real spark, and that shows both in her writing. I so wish I could have met her.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's sad that she died so young.
Yes, it's very sad. So, she worked her way up. And she when she got to New York, in the early 20s, late 19-teens and early 20s, she did befriend a bunch of women. At that time, the publishing world had just opened up the possibility of women as having leading roles in the publishing industry, but only in the realm of children's literature. So I guess they figured, well, women know about children, so they could be, have high publishing positions in children's literature. And that Rachel got to know a bunch of those people and had a very impressive circle of women friends in New York City, in the publishing industry, in the New York library system, in the a lot of the publications of the time. And so that was a huge help to her, too. But it was often hard to be a working woman and be a wife and mother. And she longed to be both. But I know that the long delay in her finding romance, finding a husband, was partly because I think women weren't really seen as, you know, able to do both of those things.
And it would have been difficult to, when starting out, to be married, probably.
Yes, yeah.
And have children.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Although there were some other, you know, writers, maybe a little later than that, who were able to combine the two.
Yes.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Robin Clifford Wood, author of The Field House, A Writer's Life Lost and Found on an Island in Maine. Now, you became interested in Rachel Field, and but going from there to writing a book, there's a few steps in between.
Yeah. So I call it 13 years, this full journey, because the research and writing part took me 9. Then it took me 2 years to find a publisher, and then about almost 2 years from the wonderful call from the publisher saying they wanted to publish my book to seeing the book arrive in my hand. So it is a very long journey. It started with me pitching the story to a magazine editor at a writing event in Maine, and I excitedly started doing the research for this, you know, 800-word story about living in Rachel Field's house. and I had so much information. I said, I could write the whole book. I'll just take a year and write the whole book. So I was quite naive at that time, and but I kind of caught the research bug, and I found archives. I was very fortunate because there are caches of Rachel Field letters all over the country, and they also, in a weird way, weird synchronicity, as my sister would call it. They all ended up in places I was going anyway. I was a full-time mom. I had 4 kids. It was a very full life, and I kept on going astray away from the writing. I wanted to write, but I'd get discouraged and leave it behind, and then I'd have a call from an archivist who said, "Oh, someone's donating the Rachel Field collection. Can I connect the two of you?" Or, "Oh, I heard you know about Rachel Field. Can you tell me about this copyright for this poem? Or can you come read this poem on top of Cadillac Mountain for a poetry event? Or can I fly you to Florida to talk about biography?" It's like, whoa, where is this even coming from? And then all of the places where these archives were where I was going to be with my family anyway. My daughter was playing softball in California for her spring college break, and so that's when I did all my California research. And I had 2 kids at Yale, and I found this amazing collection in the Yale Beinecke Library. My mom went to Vassar, and Rachel's favorite best friend editor went to Vassar, and all of her Rachel Field papers are there. And I spent a day with my mom as my research assistant going through all this stuff at Vassar. I'd love to tell you the story about another cache of letters at Tulane University.
Yes, that must have been quite a celebratory moment when you found that, because that solved one of your mysteries.
Yes, it did. So on the shelves of the Field House, there's a old Wanamaker's diary from 1928, And these, for those who don't know about it, it was like a advertising catalog, but it had journal, blank journal pages for all the days of the year. It was a very popular item. And Lucy Field, Rachel's mom, had written on a couple of pages in August of 1928, Rachel and Lyle, all devotion. She has an almost maternal care of him. And there were several other entries, but those really jumped out at me because I thought, this sounds like a love interest.
Hmm.
And so I searched around for Lyle, and I couldn't find anything about this, any Lyle. I'd pick it up. You know, as you can imagine, there were a million little threads I'd pick up and then put away and forget about. But I'd gone back to that a few times in the course of 5 or 6 years. And this one summer, my youngest daughter was about to transfer to Tulane University. And so I had about 2 weeks before we left and a quiet lull in the summer. And so I just pulled out my Rachel Field notes once again. And I found this name of someone called Lyle Saxon, who was a writer back in that time. And he did live in New York City for a short time when Rachel Field was there. So I said, could this be the guy? And with the wonders of the Internet, I was soon in touch with both of Lyle Saxon's biographers. And the second one just said, she was stunned, and she said, I can't believe you live in Rachel Field's house. I said, oh, why? She said, I have read the most incredible letters written by Rachel Field. I almost wrote her biography myself because of those letters. I've never seen anything like them. I'm sure she was in love with Lyle Saxon. And I said, oh, my gosh. I said, this is it. And then I said, where are those letters? And she said, they're in the archives at Tulane University. And here I was, just about to drive down there for the first time with my daughter. And, you know, so it just, those things just kept on being laid out in my path. So,
And that's what kept you going all those years.
That's what kept me going all those years, for sure. I felt like Rachel was really almost reaching out to me. I felt like, it became like a calling. I was like a woman obsessed. I had to write Rachel's story because she just wouldn't let me put it away.
Well, that's, you know, one of the things that amazes me is really that nobody else did, that it was so, that she was so forgotten, because being the first woman to win Newbery and winning a award?
Caldecott and the National Book Award.
Yeah, National Book Award. And she should have been much better known.
Yeah. Well, she said,
and her life should have been, you know, there should have been movies made about her and things like
that's
that.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
From some letters after her death, I know that Arthur went into a great depression. I think he was extremely protective of Rachel's sister and the, you know, the stigma around mental illness in that time was powerful, so he was very guarded about anyone ever talking about the sister. And then I don't want to give up everything about the end of Rachel's life, but her death was kind of a multi-layered tragedy. And I think that it was something that Arthur in particular probably didn't even want to talk about. His father also died within months after Rachel's death, and Rachel's mother died about a year later. So there was, you know, the people who were her champions were kind of disappearing, and I think Arthur was just, he did continue renewing her copyrights for decades, but I think he was just not equipped to stand forth in an active way to keep her tributes alive.
Well, he didn't seem like a very strong person.
No, I think anyway. He was quite dependent on her strength and spirit.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder why she was, you know, if when I read about her life as a single woman and then her life as a married woman, I'm not sure why she wanted to get married. But
yeah, well, I think she really, really wanted children. But I also think she longed for the simplicity of domestic life. She loved cooking. She was a collector of patchwork quilts and antique dolls and music boxes, and she loved entertaining. And when she got to Hollywood, she was determined to not. She was really not drawn to the glitz and glamour at all. She liked, you know, sitting down for soup in the kitchen with Arthur, or having a cookout on the beach with neighbors, which often included Vincent Price. They were sometimes famous neighbors, but she just was, you know, I think she liked the simplicity of domestic life too. So,
you know, I love the story. Can you tell the story, or maybe read the part about the actress who was in one of her movie that was being made of her book, and the story about the actress's mother?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, that was Betty Davis. That was Betty Davis, and I have all my book is bristling with little post-it notes, but I don't know if I have that particular.
Don't know where that one is.
But
okay.
I could tell you quickly. Yeah, Betty Davis.
Yes.
On the set.
Oh, it's okay. I found it. It's on page 289.
Oh wow! Good for you. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So this is in the words of Betty Davis, actually. She wrote this piece, and it's not dated, and there's no indication of where it was published, if at all. But Betty Davis was quite a big deal, and so she wrote this. Many years ago, about 10, I suppose, Mother was riding on the train between Boston and New York. The seats were pretty well filled when a girl got on the train with a dog in her arms. Because of the dog, no one seemed to want her to sit by them. The girl was embarrassed as people quickly filled their seats with packages. Mother always loved dogs, so she moved over and motioned to the girl to sit by her. Soon they were talking. Mother proudly told her new friend about her daughter, who had just been assigned a small part in a play on Broadway and who she was sure was a great actress. You know how mothers talk about their fond hopefuls. The girl told Mother that she had been a newspaper reporter for 12 years, and by the way, she wasn't a newspaper reporter, but she did do some writing for a newspaper. And hoped someday to write a play or a book, something that really mattered. Before the train got to New York, both Mother and her friend, though they never introduced themselves, had spoken of their dreams and ambitions, the friend for herself and Mother for me. Not so long afterward, Mother and I left for Hollywood. At first, it was a struggle trying to get a footing until one day George Arliss picked me for a role in The Man Who Played God. Jobs came more easily after that. Mother spent quite a lot of time with me on the sets, especially at first. She had once been a professional photographer, and her advice was often helpful. One day, while I was making All This and Heaven Too, she was visiting me at the studio. I wanted her to meet Rachel Field, the author. But before I had a chance to introduce her, she walked across the stage to greet an old friend. "Ever since that day we met on the train, I have often thought about you," I heard Mother say. "What are you doing in Hollywood?" "Well, you see, I did write a book, and the movies bought it. I am here watching it come to life. And tell me, whatever happened to your daughter?" "Well, here she is. I want you to meet her, Betty Davis. But I don't know your name." "I am Rachel Field." And Betty Davis finishes, "I wonder if there isn't some plan or reason behind such chance meetings, which I have found so often turn out to be very important in the lives of those who are strangely brought together."
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a wonderful scene, and you're right. It's just yet another uncanny coincidence that was connected to Rachel's life.
Wow. So when you wrote this book, you structured it in a way, it's fairly chronological,
mm-hmm.
but it's interspersed with your letters to Rachel and a lot of letters to and from Rachel. So it's not just you describing it. You're actually showing here's what she was saying, writing to friends, or what friends were writing to her, or sometimes about her. And then these letters that you wrote to her. So tell me how you decided to do it that way.
Sure. Well, I For years, as I said, I was carrying Rachel's torch, and I felt like I just had been chosen for this quest to write Rachel's story. And as I gathered all this material around the country, I too was in love with her writing and her letters, and also the letters of many of her friends and people who wrote about her. And so I highlighted my favorite passages all along the way, and I had this huge collection of Rachel's voice in letters that I wanted to include in the book. So a lot of the chapters were really written around the letters that I wanted to include. And so that's how that structure came about. And then I gave talks about this project for, you know, all over New England and beyond, even, you know, long before the book was actually finished. And people always said, oh, you should write about your connection to Rachel Field in the book. And I really resisted that. But people were so excited by that, part of this story. And I was really in a quandary about it, because I thought, I don't want to co-opt Rachel's story. I want to write her story. I don't want my voice to interfere with it. And then one summer, I went to a writing conference, and the faculty instructor said, as a writing prompt, he said, write a letter to someone who will never read it, or something along those lines. And it's what sprang right to me is I'm gonna write to Rachel Field. I think I wrote, "Dear Rachel, are you mad at me?" Because I sort of struggled with how she would feel about me revealing all this stuff. But I went. I mean, I wrote, you know, for the full 10 minutes or whatever we had, and it really was like breaking open a dam or something. There was so much there, and I thought, this is how I can put this together. I won't insert myself into Rachel's biography, but I'll write letters to Rachel that come before each chapter, and that way I can tell my story as a separate thread to hers, and the two threads, you know, come together in a way, because I consider her a very dear friend after all these years, even though we never got to meet. But that's it. Really, is it's a biography memoir hybrid. So it makes it unusual.
Yes, that's true. And now one of the things that is a recurring theme, seems like, for Rachel was discomfort with her physical appearance.
Absolutely, yes.
And she, you know, there's a few pictures of her in the book, although not as many as I would have liked to have seen, maybe.
Yeah.
And she wasn't huge.
You know? Yeah. Well, it's funny. You'll notice there aren't many pictures of her standing. There's a few, and and I never any place found out how tall she is.
Well, she was obviously tall, but she wasn't heavy.
Yeah. I mean, certainly she was not obese, but she was not a small. I mean, she wasn't like tall and gangly. She was a. You know, she was a substantial woman, I think you'd call her. I mean, I think in a beautiful way. But also, it wasn't just the fact that she. I think that inside herself, she felt like a. You know, she wrote about elves and fairies and sprites a lot in her early work and her stuff for children, and she was not sprite-like. So I should probably read this one poem. The other thing is,
yes,
people said, oh, she looks just like her father, that she had these sort of heavy masculine features, just like the, you know, the Field family dad that she never got to know. And and she, you know, many of her poems, her prose, her one children's novel is all about being uncomfortable in the skin you're in, sort of having a disconnect between what you look like from the outside and who you feel like on the inside. One book, Hepatica Hawks, was about a young woman who was a giantess who traveled with a circus freak show. And you know, wished to fit into the rest of the world. So, I mean, and she even said that was one of her most autobiographical books. So
I just find that so sad, but I think it's still true,
yes,
that women are kind of told or often grow up with this belief that the less room they take up physically in the world, the more attractive they are.
Oh, I love that way of putting it, Monica. You're absolutely right. Women are supposed to be delicate, like lace.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's a terrible tragedy, and it's very sad.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm tall, and I've never been uncomfortable about being tall, but I do remember, you know, feeling uncomfortable about having large feet.
Right.
I was tall and very slender for a large part of my life. Now I'm not so slender, and it's taken me a while to get used to taking up more space and feeling good about that.
Yeah. Whereas I think a lot of men are, you know, they're applauded for being large.
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
It's definitely the opposite. And, you know, the pictures of her remind me a little bit of Julia Child.
Yes, that's
the pictures of Rachel. Yeah. I think that Julia was okay with who she was physically.
Yeah. Yep. I think you're right. Yeah, I think there was this romantic side of Rachel. I've had some of one book group said to me, well, frankly, I don't think Rachel Field had she wasn't very good about choosing men.
True.
So I think this is a struggle that she, you know, contended with for much of her life.
That she didn't feel attractive.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bet having her father die so young is part of that, too.
How so, do you think?
Because she didn't have that male approval.
Yes, I see.
In her life at an early age.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've...
Yeah, read that poem for us that you're going to read.
Sure, that My Inside Self?
Yes,
And this was anthologized numerous times. This is a very... I met one woman who was a regular on Sutton Island, was so thrilled to learn. She selected this poem when she was in grade school to memorize for a school event, having no idea that it had been written by Rachel Field. But she had chosen this poem and then later found out that it was written by this famous Sutton Island woman. So it's called My Inside Self. My inside self and my outside self are different as can be. My outside self wears gingham smocks, and very round is she, with freckles sprinkled on her nose and smoothly parted hair and clumsy feet that cannot dance in heavy shoes and square. But oh, my little inside self in gown of misty rose, she dances lighter than a leaf on blithe and twinkling toes. Her hair is blowing gold, and if you chanced her face to see, you would not think she could be long to staid and sober me.
You know, we're getting short on time. Is there another section you would like to read?
I think I would like to read a bit of one of my letters, maybe just to give a sense of what those sound
Perfect.
Like.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yes.
Dear Rachel, 14 years after my first summer in your house, I began to get serious about getting to know you. It helped that I had become a year-round resident of the state of Maine. If you were working on getting my attention all that time, I apologize for taking so long to get around to the job. I have grown attached to the state of Maine just as you did. It is a place that loves its artists and writers, and I slowly, painstakingly slowly, found a place of belonging here as a writer. It was largely because of you that I finally broke into writing with conviction in the spring of 2008 when I bravely pitched an idea for a magazine feature to an editor at a writer's workshop in southern Maine. I told her about sharing a house with a famous Maine writer from long ago, and she was intrigued. That summer, I got the assignment to write the story for Port City Life magazine. I began researching in earnest for the article that would come out the following summer. I feel strange talking to you about what I read in your letters and journals. There are times when I wonder if I might know you better now than anyone ever knew you in life, because I read your childhood journals, your college letters, and all the stories of your evolving adult womanhood all at once. I got to spread the entire timeline of your life before me and study it. I unearthed secret chapters and put them together with the unexplained non-secret parts and tried to figure out how everything fit. But I won't go into all of that just now. I'll stop there, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was Robin Clifford Wood reading from The Field House, A Writer's Life Lost and Found on an Island in Maine. You know, one of the things that I really, you have to note on this is how important the archives of her letters were. And personal correspondence was so, you know, she wrote so many letters. She had so many correspondents.
Yes. Yeah,
100 years from now, are people going to be able to, you know, what? We don't do that anymore. We maybe write emails, but I don't think they're like these letters.
Yes, I totally agree. And the handwriting itself has so much character. You know.
Yes.
When we grew up, I know absolutely my high school best friend's handwriting. I see it, and it just floods me with memories of her. And I think a lot of people wouldn't even recognize their best friend's handwriting anymore.
Probably not, or even their kids.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to know because, I mean, you could say, oh, but there's such records of everyone's emails and texts, but it's too much. How could you possibly wade through all of that? I don't know. It's a whole different ballgame.
And her letters were like miniature essays sometimes. There seemed to be so much creativity that went into her letters.
Absolutely.
Particularly the letters she wrote to Lyle.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, those were absolute. I know exactly what that woman was talking about when she praised them. So, yeah, they are so passionate. Some of them almost made me cringe because of the Rachel really revealed her needy, vulnerable side with him, as I didn't see in other contexts at all. But it was just really, I mean, such a heartfelt stuff. But she also wrote these beautiful and often humorous depictions of the spring day and the city and things like that. That it was very hard to trim that chapter down because I wanted to put everything in, but. I found them charming too.
I know. It's like just a couple lines. Your letter was meat and drink and peanuts and caviar to me.
Yeah.
needless to say, I picked your letter clean as sparrows do a bit of suet by the window. Not that I resemble a sparrow or your letter suet, but I seem possessed with the spirit of simile this morning. I mean,
Isn't that wonderful? Even
the alliteration in that, it's like,
yeah.
It would seem like something that a lot of writers would labor over to get a line like that.
Yeah.
And it's just a throwaway in a letter.
Yep, that's right. And and it's handwritten, so there's no word processing back then. So either she did a lot of drafts or it just flowed out of her just like that. I'm inclined to think the latter.
Yeah, yeah. So in the few minutes we have left, Robin, tell me a little bit about your path to publication of the book. You said it took 2 years, so I'm guessing it wasn't.
Oh, the path to publication. Yeah.
Thing.
So
yeah.
I started sending out the manuscript when I finished it in 2017. And then I got sidetracked by another. I actually wrote a full-length book in the interim during those years I was working on the Field House. That was it's purely memoir, and it was around the my mother's end of life, but also my relationship with her throughout our lives. But I got quite impassioned about how we die in the United States and the problems with that. But so I was sidetracked a fair amount from this book. And so I didn't find an agent. I didn't find a publisher. I tried local publishing houses, and I had kind of set it aside when I had sent it to She Writes Press, which is this fabulous hybrid publishing model that is, you know, that's an award-winning institution now, and I see why, because they do such a wonderful job. Their cover design's fantastic. The network of women writers they connect you to is just become an essential resource for me, and so there's a lot of great things about it. But they have quite a backlog of authors, so that's partly why they were looking so far out for a publication.
Mm. And what about that makes it a hybrid press?
Well, the authors do have to buy in to the process. You pay part of the upfront fees, but you also keep a lot more of it, and you keep a lot more creative control. But they got it up on Amazon. They do all the copywriting. They are responsible for the publishing services. Ingram Publishing Services distributes it all over the country. So it's all over the internet, and you can order it from any bookstore, and that was all taken care of for me. But I had to I hired my own copy editor, but they also do copy editing, which you hire out. And a lot of the marketing is also up to me. I hired my own publicist, which is what they recommend, or mm-hmm. some people do their own marketing. So it's a combination of self-motivation and using their sources.
But they don't publish just any book.
Oh, no. It's
there's,
definitely
there's selectivity yes, about it. Yeah. All the books. I've done a number of interviews with their authors, and they've all been excellent books.
I've been excited. Really yeah. Books. I've read a number of She Writes authors now, and I've liked everyone I've read. So it's pretty.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. And as they win awards and get even more selective, I think they're getting more and more people, approaching them. So it's probably going to get harder
yeah.
and harder to,
Well, here's a shout out to the new models in publishing,
yeah.
and it'd be interesting to see what Rachel would have made of them if she were around today.
Yeah,
yeah. And Robin, we're out of time.
Well,
so
it felt like 5 minutes practically. That was really fun talking to you.
And it was a great conversation. We always like to close with a quote, and I have one from that I found on Brainy Quote. .com from Rachel Field. She wrote, "I used to think I had ambition, but now I'm not so sure. It may have only been discontent. They're easily confused."
Oh, I love that. Yeah, she was full of wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, and I hope people will enjoy the Field House. I'm happy to join book groups and talk about this anytime.
Fantastic. See you all next week on Writers' Voices.